Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
On the program today, a phrase we haven't heard in association with this White House in, what, a month or two? Maybe conflict of interest or the appearance thereof. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, July the 27th. Glad to have you along, as we always are, everybody. Setting aside for a minute the internecine battles that appear to be going on inside the West Wing of the White House. Who leaked what? To whom? Who's going to get fired or not? We are going to take a step back today and talk about who owes what to whom. Anthony Scaramucci, the new White House communications director, is, as you know, a Wall Street guy. Ran a fund of funds firm called SkyBridge Capital, which, as a condition of taking a government job, he had to sell. The chosen buyer is a Chinese company. HNA Group is its name. And that deal, first of all, hasn't closed yet, and B, is set to be under review by regulators. The Wall Street Journal pegs that deal at as much as $250 million all told. Scaramucci himself could get up to $125 million. So Marketplace's Adrian Hill gets us going with White House financials and divestments.
Anthony Scaramucci isn't the only one in the Trump administration who's needed to clean up his or her financial house to avoid conflicts of interest. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, Rex Tillerson, Betsy DeVos. It's a rich person problem. But Scaramucci's SkyBridge deal is raising eyebrows, at least some eyebrows.
I don't think that if you did a deal with China, you're automatically suspect.
Derek Scissors is a resident scholar at the conservative-leaning American Enterprise Institute. He doesn't see an immediate ethics problem. But...
I do think, you know, if someone has a lot of influence in the administration and they've just made a deal with a country that we are now, you know, at odds with over North Korea, over economic issues, you have to wonder whether they're thinking about the country or thinking about the deal.
He thinks if Scaramucci gets a bigger policy role in the administration, the pending SkyBridge deal raises bigger questions. Meredith McGeehee is from Issue One, a group that tries to reduce the influence of money in politics. She thinks it's a plenty big deal already. McGeehee calls the White House communications director job one of the most powerful public positions there is.
The words that are uttered by him or by others in that office have the power to move markets, have the power to influence policy.
And she says, have the power to send messages and affect business around the world. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
We talked a bit about interest rates yesterday on the program, Yellen and the Fed. Over in London today, the UK's main financial regulator said a key interest rate over there is going to go away by the end of 2021. LIBOR. It's called the London Interbank Offered Rate. It was the subject of a multi-billion dollar rate rigging scandal a couple of years ago. And the Brits are hoping a new benchmark, apparently going to be called SONIA, will take its place. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one.
Trillions of dollars worth of mortgages, consumer loans and other deals around the world are based on LIBOR. The benchmark was supposed to reflect the interest rates at which banks in London were lending to each other. But LIBOR had a fatal flaw, says fund manager Justin Urquhart-Stewart. It relied totally on the banker's word.
It was done in the days of where my word is my bond, and it was a gentleman's market. Unfortunately, there are no such thing as gentlemen around anymore, and so this was open to abuse, and it was abused.
At least six bankers on both sides of the Atlantic went to jail for manipulating the measure. Today, the UK's main market regulator said LIBOR will be scrapped within 4.5 years. Many Brits hope that a more reliable indicator, nicknamed SONIA, will take its place. Bank analyst Chris Wheeler.
sterling overnight index average, or SONIA, that's actually going to be calculated using the actual rate at which banks and building societies in the UK lend to each other.
But SONIA is not a shoo-in. The US is working on its own homegrown measure. So is the European Union. There's a lot at stake, says Urquhart Stewart. Whoever winds up with the next global interest rate benchmark wins credibility and business.
Yes, there's a huge competition here to try and make sure that you are seen as the centre of the whirlpool, pulling in more trades into your trading system and into your benchmark.
He believes that given the size of its economy, the US will win that competition, denting Britain's financial centre. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Speaking of dented, Wall Street today was a little bit rocky. For a change, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Paying a lot of attention to Erie, Pennsylvania this year, looking at how candidate Trump's campaign promises helped turn him into President Trump in a county that voted Democratic the last two election cycles, presidential election cycles, that is. The big promise, we're calling it. And one of the policy promises that Trump made was more school choice. His administration has followed through mostly with funding proposals for private school vouchers and charter schools. In the state of Pennsylvania, cyber charters are an increasingly popular choice. About 40,000 students, 3% of the student body in that state or so, are now enrolled in cyber charter schools, publicly funded but privately run. And as the name implies, most classes are taken online. Marketplace's Amy Scott spent some time at one virtual school in Erie.
From the outside, it would be easy to mistake the Pennsylvania Cyber Charter School for a place to get your taxes done or mail a package. The downtown Erie branch is tucked away in a strip mall across from a Big Lots discount store and a U-Haul storage center. But inside, a dozen or so kids are gathered around tables making colorful sun catchers. They're learning how a liquid becomes a solid.
Basically, you make Jell-O, but no clumps in it, and then put it on a plate and then let it dry.
That's 8-year-old Jacob Pandolf. Most school days, he and his older brother and sister log on from laptops at home in rural Union City outside Erie. But on Tuesday afternoons, the family drives 30 miles for this face-to-face science explorers class.
Everything that a traditional public school does, we essentially do that, it's just in a slightly different manner.
Brian Hayden is CEO of PA Cyber, the oldest and largest online public school in the state. He says kids also get together here for art and music. They take field trips and have German and Spanish clubs.
We are a real school, and I think sometimes that isn't the perception that people have, that we have a bunch of kids sitting in a dark room in front of a computer that's isolated from the world. And that's not what this is.
What it is to the parents of about 11,000 students enrolled around the state is an alternative to traditional brick-and-mortar schools they say haven't worked for their kids. Some families have safety concerns about public schools or kids with learning disabilities. Bridget Dolak's 8-year-old daughter Lainey has a seizure disorder and struggled at a traditional school.
And now her reading is a high third grade level. She's in second grade, and her math is on grade level. This place is a godsend for us. It's been wonderful.
It's also been like a second job for Dolak, who works from home as a social worker.
At first, it was definitely an adjustment, so I had to be there, you know, all the time. But now she's getting much better at working independently.
Lainey is in what's called the Blended Classroom program at PA Cyber. She takes one online class every week in English, math, science, and social studies, and then works on her own, watching video lessons and doing graded assignments. For more structure, families can choose the virtual classroom, which basically mimics regular school.
It says the blank ocean is the largest ocean on the Earth's surface.
Classes are taught online by live certified teachers via webcam. Students from all over the state interact using their computer's microphone or by typing. In this science class, Mr. McCoy quizzes kids about the oceans.
Which is the largest and deepest ocean? Andrew says the Atlantic. Do we agree or disagree?
12-year-old Caleb Pandolf says he likes just waking up and going to his desk every morning.
It's pretty much the same as a normal classroom. You just have to hit buttons to raise your hand and talk.
As virtual schools have grown here and around the country, so have concerns about their performance and oversight. Last year, PA Cyber's founder pleaded guilty to tax fraud for siphoning millions of dollars from the school. The nonprofit school is under new management. Brian Mann is an assistant professor at the University of Alabama and studies cyber charters. While he says there are individual success stories.
Every time they do a study that looks purely at academics, the cyber charter schools underperform compared to the traditional public schools.
One national study out of Stanford University found that compared to similar students at traditional schools, cyber students were 72 days behind in reading on average and 180 days, or a full school year, behind in math. Mann says there's a mismatch between the types of students who do well in a cyber school setting and those who tend to enroll in cyber schools.
The student has to be kind of a self-starter, independent, or have a lot of support at home. The struggle here is that the students for which the traditional public schools didn't work are often not that student.
And when those students fail online, they often end up back at the local public school. In Erie, Pennsylvania, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Most of the stories you hear about water are about fights over it. Shortages caused by drought or climate change. Cities versus farmers versus environmental groups. You know the drill. Today, though, a different kind of water story about a utility in Georgia that's trying to share. From WABE, Molly Samuel explains.
The Fayette County Water System operates a handful of reservoirs in suburban Atlanta, including one at an old mill, which is where I am, with the director of the water agency, Lee Pope.
Yes, this is the old Stars Mill that actually used to generate electricity.
We're inside the wood building. Pope opens a door and...
Whoa!
We're looking into thin air and the waterfall flowing over the dam below.
I wasn't expecting that somehow.
Don't jump.
The Fayette County Water System is in the business of selling water. It supplies about 120,000 people. So it might seem strange that Pope really wants his customers to buy less water.
A lot of people will say, hey, I want my grass to be green, and they're way overwatering, which means we're selling them more water than they really need.
He's encouraging people to be more efficient and maybe not water their lawns every day. This is actually not weird in the world of water agencies these days. Conservation and efficiency are hot topics. Here's where what Fayette County is doing gets more unusual. While he's encouraging his own customers to use water more carefully, he's also sharing water, letting more of it flow downstream out of the reservoirs.
We're asking, hey, what do we really need to release to make sure we take care of our neighbors?
Fayette County sits near the headwaters of a river. The way the water agency used to operate, it would keep all the water it was allowed to, which created problems downstream.
Those creeks have been severely strained during drought years. And under past management, those creeks have run dry.
Ben Emanuel is with the Atlanta office of the environmental group American Rivers. When creeks run dry, it's bad for the environment. And Fayette County sends water downstream to other places that need it, too. Let me back up here for a second in case you're thinking, are there really water supply issues in green, humid Georgia? There are. There have been a few big droughts, and Florida, Georgia, and Alabama have been arguing about water for decades. Right now, Georgia and Florida are duking it out in the U.S. Supreme Court. But here in Fayette County, Pope's working with environmentalists like Emanuel to make sure other people and the plants and the animals get what they need.
We still have plenty of water to meet the demands here. Why do we want to be greedy?
This doesn't really cost the water agency anything, because the way water rights work in the state, he's not losing money by letting water flow out of the reservoir, though Pope is working with environmental groups to pay for studies to figure out the best way to manage the water. Collaboration like this is rare, says Heather Cooley. She's the water program manager at the Pacific Institute, which is a water think tank based in California.
I think in many cases with water, we tend to fight over it. And there is generally a lot of conflict related to it, but there are opportunities for cooperation.
She says since water issues tend to be so local, this exact approach might not be easy to replicate in other places. But still, she hopes it could at least be a model for communities all over the country dealing with water scarcity or water quality problems.
Even in areas that don't yet realize that they have a problem. Given climate change, given continued growth, it's very likely that they will be facing something in the future.
Pope says when he talks with other people in the industry about what's going on here, they do sometimes ask him why on earth he'd release more water than he's required to. He says his answer, because it's the right thing to do. In Fayette County, Georgia, I'm Molly Samuel for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we have a population that is aging rapidly.
This country ain't getting any younger, you know. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 85.3%, 21,796. NASDAQ down 40.6%, 6,382. Tough day for tech. S&P 500 off 2 points, about a 10%, 24.75. Verizon came in above expectations in earnings this morning, up 7.6%. AT&T also riding strong earnings out earlier this week, lifted 3.6%. With healthcare still in Congress and being debated. Of course, it's in Congress. It's in the Senate, Kai. That's the big thing. Look at hospitals today. How about that? Universal Health Services cut 2.2% today. LifePoint Health provides services to small towns and rural communities, ailing nearly 0.4% today. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.31%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wind already provides more than 5% of all the power generated in this country. Not a huge amount, but pretty good. Maybe you've seen those wind farms out there. Offshore wind, though, is a trickier deal. Setting up turbines at sea is expensive, and a lot of people don't like the idea of having their ocean views ruined, which is why there's a bill making its way through Congress that would force some offshore wind turbines to be so far out to sea they couldn't be seen. Marketplace's Jed Kim explains what that might mean for wind power generation.
Offshore wind energy hasn't taken off in a major way in the U.S. Amy Grace is with Bloomberg New Energy Finance. She says it's not about turbines hundreds of feet tall blocking anyone's view.
It's the price. The price needs to come down so it can compete with other forms of generation.
Right now, offshore wind costs more than twice as much to build as wind farms on land. The largest wind farm in the U.S. was actually just announced in Oklahoma. It could send power to 1 million customers in 4 states. But that does nothing for Atlantic states, says Clint Plummer. He's VP of Development for Deepwater Wind.
Building a major wind farm in a place like Oklahoma doesn't deliver energy to the East Coast. And there's not enough land to build solar farms at scale to deliver them into these densely populated coastal areas.
Plummer's company runs the only offshore wind farm that's fully operating in the U.S., in Rhode Island, and plans to build more, including one in Maryland. A new bill in Congress could change the specifics of that. It would require that offshore wind turbines go 24 miles away from the beach to preserve ocean views. The nation's largest planned offshore wind project could be back to the drawing board if the bill passes, even though Maryland is part of an East Coast regional project to promote renewable energy. Timothy Fox is with Clearview Energy Partners.
This is absolutely an example of how a federal lawmaker could hinder, if not halt, a state-level proposed and supported project.
U.S. Wind has plans to put dozens of turbines 17 miles off of Maryland's coast, 7 miles closer than the bill allows. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
$6.7 billion. That's how big, on an annual basis, the marijuana economy in this country is estimated to be. The cannabis research firm ArcView Group is the source of that number, which is a source of consternation to companies hoping to profit in pot. Here's the deal. We learned this morning that the High Times Corporation, publisher of High Times Magazine, sponsor of the annual Cannabis Cup, is going public October, probably. And while more states are legalizing medical or recreational marijuana, pot is still illegal at the federal level, leading some investors to try to play it safe. Marketplace's Ryan Kyloff has the story.
A few years ago, Nancy Brockelman was suffering painful psoriatic arthritis. When her son Franco suggested medical marijuana, she said,
"Never. I'm 65 right now, and I never did pot."
But about a year of pain later, she finally said to her son,
"I'll try it, but you got to be here, you know. Don't leave me stranded here."
Brockelman started monitoring his mom's pot use, reactions, and side effects. That gave him the idea to track all of this in an app.
We call them the mom tests.
Today, Franco's company, ReLeaf, has 8 employees, and it's partnered with dispensaries in 10 states. The app gathers patient data about the effects of different strains of marijuana and sells that to dispensaries to help improve their customer service. Attorney Hillary Bricken's firm focuses on the weed industry, and she says the weed-adjacent industry is growing.
The major money is really going to companies that actually do not do anything with the plant.
Bricken says because marijuana is still illegal at the federal level, her investor clients are wary of weed growing or selling operations. But they love things like the High Times IPO announced today.
Yeah, that's a beautiful investment. It's got all of the bells and whistles of the industry without actually violating any drug laws.
Troy Dayton of research firm ArcView Group says it's not just the legal protection. Ancillary businesses always thrive around a booming industry.
You know, there's the Mark Twain quote about the best time to be in the pick and shovel business is during a gold rush.
ArcView expects the weed industry to grow over 25% annually through the end of the decade. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
Not to get all depressing on you here, but life being what it is, we're all getting older. More of us, in fact, are getting more old, if that makes any sense at all. AARP says the 80 to 90-year-old demographic is the fastest-growing chunk of the population in this country. 100 and up is the second fastest. You play out that train of thought, and you start realizing what it means for the American labor force and, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, for the idea of retirement in this country.
Vivian Lowe is 67 years old. She loves her grandkids.
So I'm here at the summer camp, picking up my grandchildren after their summer day camp now.
But she also loves her job at a hospital in Southern California.
I've always wanted to be a nurse. I love being able to be of service to patients.
So when it came time to retire, she kind of didn't want to, at least not all the way. So she didn't. She basically kept one foot in the door at the hospital.
It really depends on the tasks that need to get done. So I could have a week where I would be here as little as, you know, 4 hours to 8 hours. And then I could have a week where I'd be here like 25 hours.
Lowe worked this out with her employer, and it's what's known as flexible retirement.
An individual who may be close to their normal retirement age chooses to stay with an organization in some capacity in a different work arrangement or schedule.
Lenny Santacola is with World at Work, an HR professional association.
It offers employers the opportunity to retain people that have a lot of historical knowledge.
Nurse Lowe sees this every day.
Sometimes I'll get a call with, you know, we can't remember why we decided to do X, Y, or Z. And then I could say, well, you know, we tried this, you know, 10 years ago, and here's what went well and here's what didn't.
But this arrangement that Lowe has at her hospital, it's not super common. A June GAO study estimates 5% of employers offer it as a formal option to people close to retirement age. World at Work says up to a third of employers may at least occasionally offer it to some employees. Santacola says it's uncommon because it's not without its challenges for some companies.
Sometimes you have a stacking effect, which is where the older folks are not exiting the organization and then the newer employees can't move into new positions.
But a lot of observers say flexible retirement is becoming more common in the United States because it has to.
We have a population that is aging rapidly, so we're going to have many more older people than we have in the past.
Lori Trewinski is with the AARP Public Policy Institute. Birth rates, meanwhile, are at a record low.
So as a result of this, employers are going to face shortages of knowledge and skills.
Knowledge and skills possessed by older Americans that Trewinski adds are sometimes overlooked. Meanwhile, some older Americans need to stay in the workforce longer.
People are living longer, and as a result, they have to finance a longer period of retirement years.
Finally, as the share of retired people in the U.S. economy rises, you have a larger chunk of people who aren't working, and that can be a damper on economic growth.
So it will be very important for employers in this country to find ways to help retain the older workforce.
America is getting older. So inevitably will its workforce. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today from the workplace website Glassdoor, their site over in the UK, a survey of the most hated office jargony phrases. I'll pause here for a beat or two to let your own come to mind. Okay, you ready? Top of the list, touch base, hated by 24% of respondents. Blue sky thinking, 21%. My own pet peeve, although it is not somehow in this survey. Going forward, I hate that one. Give us yours. Tweet them at us. At Marketplace, I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Let us know. All right, we are going. The Dow up 85 points today, about 0.3%. NASDAQ down 0.46%. S&P 500 off 2, about 0.1%. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Troe are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor for now is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.